Hey, you're listening to Blindsight. Let's go. Mental health isn't something to take lightly. It's time to fight. It's time to thrive. Let's do this.
Welcome to Blindsight. I'm your host, Bill Lundgren, and I'm real excited to be talking with our guest today. And we'll be talking about step five. As you know, we've been covering each of the steps because it's important for us to be aware of it and also to understand that it is not the 12 steps are lifestyle changes that apply whether we're addicted, whatever it is. We can find, I hope, as a result of this program, we can get help you find some benefit from at least being aware of the 12 steps. And today, I have another podcast personality is going to be helping us. Pinella Rieta is our speaker today. And the name of your program is?
Oh, it's My Badass Recovery. I know, we begin with a cuss word. What are we going to do?
Right, exactly, which makes it all the more fun.
Exactly.
Yeah, great. Well, I'm glad to have you on board. Could you also remind people about what the fifth step is?
Yes, absolutely. Well, for starters, thank you for having me here. I am so excited to be with you guys. I'm honored and thrilled to talk about this particular step because it's a beautiful step that can be a little scary. We admitted the nature to our wrongs to ourselves and to another human or something along those lines.
Right.
Mm-hmm. It just felt so daunting to me.
Sure.
Yeah. Well,
do you have an idea why? Because I think everybody had the same feeling, mm-hmm. but if you can kind of express it for people and kind of take some of the weight off.
Well, I'll give you a little context. So I started my process of recovery in 2009. I was 35 years old at the time. And part of what was happening for me is, of course, like all of us, I was using my drinking as a solution. It was my medicine. I wasn't trying to, you know, do anything terrible every time I drank, although terrible things happened. I was just trying to, you know, step out of a life that I couldn't deal with. And so when I went through this process of the 12 step and I did my 1, 2, and 3 and I got clear and I was able to understand that I wasn't a terrible person, but rather someone that was struggling with addiction in step one. And I realized I couldn't do it alone in step two. And I was willing, you know, to do the work and connect with something bigger than me in step three. And then in step four, asked to put pen to paper and do an inventory of all the things, you know, all the skeletons in the closets, all the fears, all the harms, all the things. That alone was hard. But the idea of discussing that and putting that out in the light in step five with another human being was so very daunting, specifically because I believe that this is not unique to me, but I felt like I was the only one that had gone through these horrible things while in my addiction. And so I was very married to this idea that I'd been a bad person. You know, that
shame.
Yeah, exactly. It was like I'd done a lot of things that were bad and they were wrong. And I guess these two words, bad and wrong, or not moral or whatever. It was just so much shame. And so when you're in a box of
unforgivable.
Shame.
Unforgivable. The other word is
mm-hmm. Absolutely. So when you're in that box of shame and you feel like that is where you are supposed to live because you're the only one that has done that, and you're getting clear on addiction being a thing, a condition of mind and body, and yet you still carry that weight and you have to talk about these things with another human being. It's just, it's terrifying, Bill. So that's...
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That's where it began. That's not where I am
once
now.
Once you say to yourself, once you kind of spell it out, say, okay, now it's got to be a secret between me and me.
Yeah, I think that... It's kind of scary because at that point, I think that I was so confused with what was true and what was a lie. And I think that that's part that speaks to our disease, right? We confuse the truth with the false. And so for me, I'd fed myself all of these stories of who I was at the time. And the truth is, these stories were directly tied to the behavior and the actions that I took as a result of either my craving or my drinking. Or my seeking the drink. And so I had all of these stories or this identity that had been wrapped around the actions of my drinking. And the identity was rough. I mean, for any human being, it's rough. For a girl in her, you know, mid-adulthood, it's rough. For, in my case, a single mom, it was rough because I wanted to be a good girl and I wanted to be a good human. And these stories were more along the lines of, I become really slutty when I drink, which is very shameful for any human, but especially I think for a woman. I associated my bad behavior also with really immoral, and it went against what I grew up believing I should be and I would be as a good Catholic girl. And so, again, I think it was very deep because step five was calling me to share the deepest, darkest, what I called my little demons or my secrets that I was not really ready to share with the world. I didn't understand that all of this was a result of shame and that also these were just lies that I'd been telling myself that were really just manifestations of what addiction was doing in my life. So, yeah, I was telling myself I couldn't say this or else my sponsor would think less of me.
Right. The shame that comes. Yeah. And the fact, as a woman, there's certain expectations, unrealistic as they are, there's certainly expectations of purity and virtue and so forth.
Yeah.
And if you don't measure up to that, you're going to be shamed.
Yeah. Yeah, it was terrifying. I'm grateful that I had a sponsor that was so wise and so lovely. And she was able to give me that sense of safety and to really express to me that this was a hard part of the process. But she did say, if you do this and you're radically honest, you will get free. And I couldn't believe in myself, but I had to believe in her and in the process. And so that was the entry point to a complete shift as I did go through the steps.
How did you select her to be the one to receive that information? I know, you know, we could go to, if you're a Catholic, you can go in the confession booth and you've got a priest that you hope is going to be helpful.
But you hope.
You certainly hope, not always, but the question is, how did you, what made you select her to say, okay, I'm going to get rid of this and this is the safest person that I can think of?
Yeah, that's a beautiful question. And it's such a scary thing when we begin this process. How do I pick this sponsor? Especially when we don't really trust ourselves because we're so broken. And we don't trust, we have no access to our intuition because I believe that comes as a result of connecting to higher power, as a result of doing the steps. And so to answer your question, she was joyful. She just came across as someone who was free. And I heard very much her stories that she would throw out constantly, both in meetings. That's why it's so important to share in meetings this transformation. Right. Because she kept talking about this prison that, you know, her mind and her body and her spirit were in for so long. And how working these steps set her free. And that interested me. I was like, I want that. I don't know how she got it, but I want it. And so to be honest, Bill, it was more of an instinctive, you know, selection of her. And I'm grateful because she really was an incredible mentor to me and exactly what I needed at the time.
Higher power, maybe, put the two of you together.
Yes. When I say instinct, that's the secret code name.
Yeah. You got it. You got
yeah.
it.
Yeah, higher power. Yeah, she actually, in step two, it was so beautiful. And I think that this really set the path for my feeling safe and in step five with her. In step two, she asked me, you know, if I had any conception of higher power and what was that for me. And she explained, you know, each person can have their own conception. And that felt good to me because I was carrying so much prejudice as I came into, you know, just my religious upbringing. And she helped me separate that. But she did say, what's your higher power? And I said, God. And she said, where does God live? And I, you know, kind of pointed out, and I, you know, for those that are not seeing me, you know, flapping my arms in expansiveness, I made a you know, a sign of like all around me. And she very sweetly put her hand on like close to my heart. And she said, and there. And all of a sudden, like I felt this just rush of peace and joy. And I felt, I don't know what this I'm walking into, what this thing is, but I have to walk into it. And I think that was part of why I knew that she was the person that had been handpicked by something bigger than me to do this with. So, yeah, I'm grateful. Not everyone has that experience, but I'm grateful.
So how did you do it? I mean, you know, like, you know, for a month of just unloading everything, or one session, or writing it.
Yeah. I think that one thing that's tricky, I'm grateful you asked that, because one thing that is tricky, and by no means is my experience the only experience. I mean, each person has their own journey. But what I'm so grateful is that she was such an advocate of the steps and the work as it is outlined in the book. And so there were few gray areas under her mentorship. And I'm grateful because the fellowship that I went into was very much like that. I really focused on big book study meetings and 12-step meetings. And I avoided anything else because I wanted to make sure that I did this, not in a way that was right, but in a way that was going to help me, in a way that was going to prove, you know, the most helpful. And on step five, she really guided me through some of the worksheets that come from the pages of the book. And so I think four and five are tricky because we can fall off a cliff. Like, I literally have met people that have spent a year putting together that step four. And I think that would have been a promise of relapse for me. Like, I needed to get very... I needed a framework under which to work on so that I could move forward without falling off a cliff, without writing a novel right. of the drama of my life and then diving so much into my stories and my resentments and victimhood on my own, you know? And so with her, it was like she would give me a time frame. She was like, here are the worksheets, here are the instructions, and you have a, you know, 3 weeks to whatever the timeline was. I think it was 2 weeks or 3 weeks. And so I did exactly what I was told. There was a willingness to follow the guidance. And then I think we did step five over a weekend. And so we met at her house, like from 10 a.m. to 5 a.m. to 5 a.m. We would have gone there, but no, 5 p.m. And I think we met for a couple more hours the next day. And so it was very intense, but it was yes. by design because it was a true immersion into this place where you get to get really honest, you know, share. She said something brutal to me, Bill, at the beginning, and I didn't understand it, and it hurt my feelings. At the beginning of it, she said, I'm not here to be your friend, which was, like I said, really shocking because I did feel close to her up right. until then. And she said, I'm not here to be your friend. I'm not here to be your mother. I'm not here to be your teacher. I'm here to put up a mirror so that you can see your own inventory through new eyes and so that I can show you a new way of taking ownership of your side. And that phrase, I'm not here to be your friend, was so radical.
Sure.
Yeah, because all of a sudden I'm like, what do you mean you're not here to be, you know? And as we went through the steps, through my inventory, she kept saying it. Because every time that I would bring up a story that I thought was going to get me the normal reaction of, oh, right, poor you,
which poor was baby,
exactly
poor baby,
what the world would normally do. Like, oh my
right,
God,
right.
That was so, people wronged you. And she wasn't doing that, Bill.
Yeah, and that encourages us to manipulate what we're saying so we look good.
Exactly. And so any vestige of performative acts that I was ready to, because let's face it, I mean, at least for me, what I really wanted was to, back to what I said earlier, to not have to share things that would make me look bad.
Right, of course.
I wanted her approval. I was scared of her judgment. I was scared of my own freaking judgment.
Right.
And so I think at the beginning, to get that honest with her, saying, I'm not here to be your friend, I'm here to put up a mirror and help you. And that invited me into a different level of honesty, because otherwise we would have wasted just a weekend. And I could have manipulated, just like you said. She probably would have gone right through my bullshit. But ultimately, the thing is, as you're doing the steps, you just need to realize this is the opportunity for you to get free. So don't wash over it with shame or even worse, lies or half-truths. It's scary, but it's worth it.
Yeah, it is scary. But the thing is, I know for me to say, you know, to tell somebody that deep secret, and I would be afraid that that person would not like me anymore.
Yeah, yeah. How did you get past that fear, Bill?
Well, sometimes it's very hard. It's like, you know, you swallow real hard. How did you get past that feeling? I mean, she was very blunt with you.
She was
not
very
many,
blunt.
Many people are.
She was very blunt. My journey has two different stages. I did the steps with her. And I want to say, Bill, that I probably committed and I did everything to the best of my ability at the time.
At the time, right.
At the time. The thing is, I'm also someone who struggles with codependency, which is just as difficult and as disconnecting as substance use, as my alcoholism. And I also struggle with love and sex addiction, which is, again, how shame-free has this process allowed me to be that I can say that without an iota of shame, which for women especially is hard, right? And I it's all wrapped around PTSD from things that happened in my past. We all have those stories. I'm not unique. But what I'm saying is in this first round of healing through the 12 steps, I didn't know I had all of these things. I didn't know I had all of these layers. I didn't know. She didn't know. We were just trying to go as deep and as, you know, as healing into this journey as we could. But what I'm telling you is that's why at the time I did 80% of the work, but the other 20% was unavailable to me. And so it was in my journey, the way that it panned out, I had 5 years of sobriety as a result of working these steps, as a result of connecting with higher power and being in a fellowship that kept me connected to that. But then I disconnected myself from it because of my codependency. I married somebody who suggested he needed more time, and I was doing too much of the program. And I said, great, let's, you know. And so I disconnected myself from everything that was keeping me sane and sober. And very quickly, it came back. And so in my story, not in everyone's story, but in my story, I did have a deep relapse that was, in fact, part of my growth, part of my recovery. And when I came and I experienced all sorts of horrible things, you know, during this new cycle of, you know, drinking. Right. It was really bad. Really, really bad. I lost my marriage. There's so many things. Lost my job. I literally almost died. And when I started my journey back into the 12 steps, I was determined to have step 4 and step 5 be different. I didn't know it at the time. I just had a wild instinct, to God-given, that I needed to open doors that I didn't in the first roundabout. And I say this because even though my story is whatever my story is, for your listeners, I want to say part of the freedom that is promised is really just proportional to the level of honesty that we can bring and the ability to just push past that fear and push past that shame, which is, again, very hard, but it is such an invitation to do the work. Because the truth is, even though I didn't have that knowledge or the access to it, in step five, the second time, I was able to at least word stuff that I was guided into new terrain with my then sponsor, so that I could start to see patterns of my obsession, not with just drinking, but with the people that I had handed my life to, my codependency, mm-hmm. and all the other addictions, all the other isms. And so, to wrap up this very long story, is the more that you surrender, I think that's a good word perhaps to use, your fear, the more that you're willing to do the deep dive into this step, knowing that it will set you free, the more you heal. It's scary as hell, but let's just go. Yes, it is scary. You know?
Yeah. Well, I think there's a part of us that really tries to keep certain things locked up, and we may not even be aware of it until, as in your situation, you know, the relapse occurred, and that was a learning relapse, hard learning, but it says you've got to open that last box.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you've got to, you know, and that it's unfortunate. I know that, you know, there are things that, oh, I'm not going to tell somebody that. Or, no, right. You know, and yet that's the thing that keeps not only the information trapped, but me trapped.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And the problem with the problem with this whole process is that we keep thinking, we keep seeing ourselves through the eyes of shame. I believe that shame, like, and I always, when I say it, I imagine it in my head with big, like, high caps, shame, you know, because it's like, for me, it's this identity that I had wrapped around everything that I defined to be truth about me. And so I don't believe that we talk in the 12 steps enough about shame. I think that perhaps to me, that's one of the things that I'm so passionate as a coach, as a mentor, as someone that has talked about my recovery out loud, that shame is the ultimate enemy, right?
We
are so wrapped up in the fear and the judgment. And I think that when we begin to see ourselves, you know, as people who have this shame so close to our skin that we can't even identify it, mm-hmm. and we start to address it and put words to it and invite other people to look at themselves, and then we bring in the element of compassion. It's this beautiful thing that I know that you're so familiar with, and probably everyone listening is so familiar with, this idea that in the clarity of understanding the source, the nature of our disease, of our addiction or addictions, and many of us, for many of us, addictions, that it isn't our fault, because it is something that is just factual, right? Like, we didn't choose it. It is not right or wrong. It is not good or bad. It is just factual. We have a condition of mind and body that has disconnected us. And when we try to stop doing something that has negative consequences, we can't. We begin again and the cycle begins. It's as simple as that. If that is present, it isn't our fault, but it is our responsibility. And so it's in this process, this beautiful duality of saying, well, I'm here. I'm not going to judge or shame or guilt or blame. I'm just going to be with this and take ownership of it. And if you wrap all of that with compassion while still holding yourself accountable to do the work, then right. mm-hmm. I think that's kind of the magic formula to push past that shame and push that past that fear. And then just, you know, one baby step at a time, keep moving forward. That's how you get out of that.
Do you see a difference between shame and guilt?
Yes. And I have the language very clear for me because I am someone who has experienced the difference, but also because I have the language of a mentor and teacher and author. Her name is Dr. Brené Brown, and she talks about shame, so shame and guilt so beautifully. So I will quote her, not quote, but the concept.
Yeah.
In that guilt is this feeling that something that I have done has failed or hasn't worked well or hasn't succeeded. And so what I have done and action was a failure. And so I can learn from it and I can get out from there. So in a sense, that is the healthy version of the two feelings, because mm-hmm. shame, instead of feeling like I did something that was wrong or a failure, I feel like I am wrong.
There you go.
Or a mm-hmm. failure. And that disconnects me from the idea that I can be lovable, that I can be enough, and that I can move forward from there, because it's just a breaking of my spirit. And when you add enough of those, it will keep you tethered to so much pain that, well, we end up going to the solution and we know what works.
Sure, right? Absolutely. But
yeah.
But sometimes we're raised with the idea that the thing we do has something to do with us, instead of being able to detach it and say, something that was unproductive is the word I like to use for myself.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, look, how many of us grew up in families where our most loving people around us, you know, our parents, our siblings, our early caretakers, they would use language that made us feel like we were wrong. Like we weren't enough.
You're
like
a bad girl. Exactly. You did that.
Exactly. Yep. Mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm. I mean, I mentioned earlier, I wanted to be a good girl. And right. my addiction had me in scenarios where I was, by no definition of the word, being good, you know, and that put me in scenarios where the next day I had to be dealing with the hangover, the physical one, which was always, you know, worse than the last one. But then right. I had this like horrible emotional hangover, which ultimately was shame. And so mm-hmm. one feeds off on the other. That's why these conversations to me are so powerful, Bill, because what I didn't understand in these first 5 years of my sobriety was how shame and fear, really, with the hand in hand for me, especially, you know, in the context of step five and actually getting honest with ourselves and then someone else, it just keeps you bound in a state where the only available resource is to run back to my addiction.
Right. And
I mean, I had put the wine down in that early sobriety, but I was still using the other coping mechanisms, my other addictions, to relieve me of that pain, which was ultimately a disconnection with my higher power and with my own self. And so this telling somebody else, going back to your earlier question about shame, and I brought in Brené Brown, and she does actually talk about how do you get rid of shame? Because, okay, great, now I have the definition of guilt and shame. And we're talking about shame being so dangerous and poignant for all of us and real. And so the question would be, you know, well, how do you get rid of the shame? And what she suggests, which is so coincidentally, falling into in line with step five, is share it with another human. Talk about it. And when you light up the stage for shame and you shine a light and you like literally put the reflector on it, it's like kryptonite for it. It just right. it fizzles out. You know, I just told you a minute ago, I shared with all of your listeners, you know, this terminology that is so shameful, sex addict. Oh my God. You know, what does that even mean? And all of a sudden you have these like tons of, you know, ideas, and it's a hard term. And so, and like I said, especially for a woman. And so,
right.
So to get there, to talk about it, but it's funny because for a long time I knew that this was a thing for me, but I didn't know. And again, just wrapped with shame and bad and wrong and da 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 da.
And now, and anything having to do with sex is
absolutely.
Yeah, the shame goes up, you know, like, yay, absolutely. The big sign.
Absolutely. Like, even going through it in the inventory, the sex inventory, it was so prickly and it was so confusing, you know? Yeah. And so many people don't even know how to explain it. And it boils down to just instincts run wild and you giving power to things that have nothing to do with the connection that we are seeking, and then getting more disconnected ultimately through your actions and those desires. And so to get to a point where I am able to just say it, to share it with, you know, one-on-one with the people that I sponsor, my clients and my coaching practice, you know, stages where I identify as that, there's the initial like, oh my God, am I really saying this? You know, what if my mother is listening? What if my son is listening? What are they going to think of me? Right? Right. And then immediately that beautiful space where I believe my truth and my freedom is way more important than the stories of who's going to tell me or who's going to judge me or who's going to hear.
Right.
And my freedom comes from adding that lamp or shining that lamp into the shame. Sorry. See, even my bodily reactions as I'm like, my throat is closing up going, no, don't say that.
Yeah, our body's reacting.
Right. My body's like, no, truth. Let's close the throat. Let's not say that, because I am wired for silence.
Sure.
But we're as sick as our secrets, right?
Yeah. Right. Exactly. And that's what has to stop. But we also have to be very selective about who we choose to reveal that to.
Yes.
Until we feel comfortable with the truth.
Oh, you're so wise. Thank you for reminding me and your audience of that. You cannot go out into the world and share this without being guided, just like you said, by that little voice of intuition. How, when, to whom? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yep. Yes. Which at some point you have that intuition, if you have gotten to a place where you have that access to that connection with higher power, working the steps, all the things. But initially, that's why it's so beautiful to select a sponsor or a mentor to help you get untangled. Right. When do I share this? With whom do I share this? In my fifth step, I remember that was one of the biggest things. At the time, I was going through a messy divorce and a custody battle. And, you know, we talked about how and when do I disclose this new understanding of at the time felt like my crazy behavior, but ultimately it was my alcoholism. You know, and I was terrified. I was like, am I supposed to go up in front of the judge in the next court hearing and be like, Your Honor, I'm an alcoholic? You know?
Yeah, exactly.
You know? And my sponsor was like, no, hell no, because, you know, custody. So no, we're not going to do that. And then at some point, I was the first one to know when it was the right time to share it with my ex-spouse and access a place of more connection. And the irony is that it is 15 years later, and now he is the one coming to me saying, I am so excited to share with you my 3-month chip. And so a million years later, which has felt a million years later, he has actually opened the door to his own radical honesty and doing the work himself for his alcoholism as well.
Yeah, well, sometimes we turn out to be an example to other people to get rid of the shame that we had to learn to get rid of.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's the exciting part, is to say, we're a role model. We can survive getting rid of the shame.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We don't have to have it. We don't have to keep it.
Yeah. And trust your intuition in that if you start to share it with someone and all of a sudden you feel like that person is giving you judgment or shame or there's no compassion or it starts to open up all of these, you know, old ways of feeling, you have every right to just say, all right, this is not a person with whom I'm sharing any longer.
You got it. You got it.
You know, I mean, it's a double-edged sword. It's the shame we put on ourselves and the judgment we put on ourselves and then the one that we allow for other people. And so I think that we at this point can clearly say, look, we just stop allowing our own self and others to continue propagating the shame in us. No more.
Well, you see, that's the tricky part that people kind of try to figure out. How much do I share is really dependent on who you're sharing with.
Yeah.
Even in dating, I encourage, you know, a client to measure out how intimate they allow themselves to be, and I'm talking about verbal intimacy, because you've got to listen to the other person and see if that person goes with you and shares on the same level.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because we meet these people, and 10 minutes after we meet them for the first time, they've told their entire life history, and we're walking around with all this, this stuff that we didn't need.
Right. Yeah, yeah, you're right.
It's okay to measure, but don't hold back if you feel you have the sense that your intuition says this person is safe.
Yeah. I think that there is some sort of a weird process, or at least it was like that for me, Bill, where at the beginning I felt this need to overshare because it was like I was just purging of my own, like, you know, I was experimenting. What does it feel like to actually be honest with the world? And there were many a Kroger cashier that were asking me how my day was. And I told them my whole life story. It was really scary, a very traumatic experience for them. I could tell. you know, bank tellers, I mean, you name it.
And that's what we're talking about. Yeah,
yeah. Exactly. And you know, I mean, it is. I think it's just a very sweet part of the process, but hopefully the people listening can have a good chuckle, but also know that it really is the preciousness of our own story that we have to keep close to our hearts. Who do you disclose this journey to? I mean, I'm in the business of actually telling my story so that I help other people tell their stories and set them free, because that's what I've chosen to do as a profession, you know, through my Badass Recovery. But I recognize that, and I tell my, you know, my clients, you don't have to go around waving the flag of all your addictions as your identity, because that also can be painful. Like, measure it
and
out.
It's more than somebody wants, and it's more than you need to give them until the trust has been built between you and the other person.
Trust. You said it, Bill. Trust. It's the trust with another human, and it's also a little bit trust with yourself, isn't there? Like, at the beginning, I don't have that trust with myself just yet. I think that's a result of doing the steps, and that's a result of being in connection with higher power. And so when you don't have that framework of trust, it's like you're just vomiting your story to whoever will catch it. And you don't realize that ultimately kind of breaks your trust with your own self again and again. And so I love that we're talking about this, because until you don't have that safety within, perhaps it's a good idea to just continue doing this very sacred journey until you feel whole enough and safe enough within you and in that relationship with your truth and your higher power where you do get to share it, you know? and have it be something that ultimately helps the other person, which is the hope, right? You're not doing it to right, show off, although yeah. mm-hmm. I feel pretty much like a badass for having gone through this. and I think it helps other people to see themselves as, you know, badass warriors, survivors, rock stars, all the things. But also the idea is precisely that, like, why are you sharing your story?
Yeah.
You know?
When they're not ready for it.
Yeah. Yeah. My sponsor was always big on what's your motive? And it was like, what do you mean? Yeah. What do you mean? Look at that. Yeah. Yeah. What's your motive? Are you trying to play victim? Are you trying to make them change their mind? Are you trying to elicit a reaction? Or are you really just sharing from your heart for connection? What is your motive? So,
well, I think that you have been a wonderful guest mm-hmm. on this program, and I'm very grateful for you being on and sharing what you have with our listeners, because I think I certainly hope this will be beneficial to all. And, you know, I wonder if there's any last words you want to leave to our listeners to kind of close things out.
Well, thank you. And thank you for opening up this conversation and for your mission and for, you know, doing what you're doing, because I love the idea of us talking more about this 12-step process.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. I think that is probably one of the biggest things we can do in the world as people in recovery. And so really that's where my last thoughts are, that this journey is a journey of the heart. And in my first roundabout with it, as I was saying, back at the beginning, I didn't understand how incredibly powerful this process was. And that's why there was so much fear. And that was, there was so much resistance internally. And I was waiting for me to give myself a green flag. Like I was still of the mind of, I do what I feel like doing. Like if I feel like telling them this, then I will. If I feel like, I was still operating from that perspective, whereas my suggestion now is to enter it with a process of faith that is more like, I'm going to take the step and then see what happens. Like I'm going to do the action and then wait for a feeling or see what feeling happens. So that in the fifth step, instead of saying, well, if I feel like sharing or if I feel brave or if I feel like being honest, I want to invite people to just think of this as the wildest, perhaps most uncomfortable and fearful scenario, but that it's almost like the graduating ceremony into a leap of faith. Because when you do share all your dirty laundry, or it feels like really dirty laundry, with another human being, trusting that this process will get you free, trusting that your conception of higher power, no matter how defined or undefined it is at this point, will catch you. And that by doing what you committed in step three, right, to doing, which is, I'm going to do the rest of this work and see what happens, which ultimately a, you know, promise that you make to the world, but mostly to yourself, that new things will happen. Like literally you can have and will have a completely new experience your life. And so my suggestion is just leap and push past all of that fear, because what will be unveiled, which is very unique to each person, still will carry a level of freedom that is just precious and worth doing. So
what a wonderful closing.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
I really appreciate your thoughts and appreciate having you on. I hope we can have you on again.
I would love that. I'm so grateful for every one of your listeners, for you guys doing this, and for you, Bill. It's so lovely to be with you, and you know,
thank you.
Someone who has had your journey as well. So thank you for that honor. I really appreciate that.
Well, thank you, and we appreciate our listeners, and I want to let our listeners know that if they want to give us some feedback, there is the feedback line, a telephone line, which is 720-712-8856. And also, you can get us by email through feedback@aftersight.org. Thank you very much, and have a great week.